Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unusual Sunday session of the United States Senate ahead of a midnight deadline when three provisions of the USA Patriot Act expire, and speak with constitutional lawyer and former Associate Deputy Attorney General Bruce Fein. He's the author of American Empire Before the Fall, and we will discuss the impasse in the Senate with Majority Leader McConnell unable to round up enough votes while Senator Rand Paul threatens to filibuster any bill that restores the NSA's bulk collection of metadata, the lone wolf provision, and the roving wiretap provision that will all likely expire at midnight. Then we will speak with Mike Rogers, a gay political activist, blogger, and the vice chairman of Raw Story, Inc. He is a leading subject of the 2009 film Outrage, which is about outing closeted politicians who vote against gay rights. And we will discuss the, in quotes, past misconduct of former Republican House Speaker Dennis Hastert that is alluded to in an indictment that charges Hastert with illegally structuring bank withdrawals totaling $1.7 million to an unnamed person referred to as Individual A, who Hastert had agreed to pay $3.5 million in hush money. We'll also look into the lucrative lobbying business Hastert has been involved in that would allow him to lavish millions on Individual A to cover up a prior sexual encounter. Then finally, we'll examine the possibility that there will be a war between Israel and Hezbollah this summer that will likely deal a death blow to President Obama's opening with Iran, that so far the powerful AIPAC lobby, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and his Republican supporters have been unable to stop. Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran, joins us to discuss the possibility of war and his article with Paul Piller in the Huffington Post, The Iran Talks Game Changer, an Israeli-Hezbollah War. And joining us now is Bruce Fein, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fein is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fein.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Ian.
And on this Sunday, there's a rare session of the Senate. And it just seems like a complete standoff. Mitch McConnell doesn't have the votes, and Rand Paul has threatened to filibuster. And the easiest option that the Senate has would be to just sign on to the House bill, the USA Freedom Act. But apparently that's not going to happen with Mitch McConnell.
No, it's not. And just for the background of your audience, Ian, A Patriot Act for this particular bulk metadata collection program, Section 215, had an expiration date of June 1, that is tomorrow. And the other thing that's peculiar about the statute at present is that a U.S. Court of Appeals has held that the language in the statute does not authorize what the NSA has been doing for the last 9 years, that is, collecting telephony metadata on every single call you or me or anybody in the United States made. That would mean that if we make 15, 16 calls a year, they've got 45 or 50,000 metadata points to look at. But putting that aside, if the courts have held that the language does not authorize what the NSA is doing, it's sort of bizarre that Senator McConnell wants to extend the same language, which basically is extending a piece of paper with no writing on it. But that's maybe political posturing, and it's hard for a lay person to understand that. But to your larger question, it does not look as though Senator McConnell has the votes really to do anything, which means the expiration date of June 1 would hold.
So is there a strategy there? It's hard to find one. In other words, is McConnell going to turn around and say now the nation's at danger because of the lone wolf provision and the roaming wiretaps? There are three issues along with the metadata, right?
Well, there are three that in 215, there's nothing that would prevent, next week from just passing those provisions, Lone Wolf, as a separate bill, or the roving wiretap. With regard to Lone Wolf, however, it's another example of overreach. It's been there for 10 years or more, and it's never been used. It's supposed to be the cornerstone, you know, of our defense against terrorism, and never been used once in its entire existence. It's just an example of the intelligence community just imagining all sorts of very speculative dangers and then saying, all right, well, we ought to have authority to encroach on liberty for that purpose. And that misunderstands, I think, a critical component of this whole debate, Ian, and understanding who we are as a country. Now, unlike other countries, liberty is our glory. Liberty is the center of our constitutional universe. And that philosophy is enshrined in the Fourth Amendment, where you have a right to be let alone unless there's probable cause to believe that you're implicated in some kind of crime or international terrorism. That's, and you don't need to give a reason why you want to be let alone. You can be let alone just because you feel like it. And the burden in our philosophy of government is on the government to come up with some good, strong reason as to why they should encroach on your liberty. And after 9 years with this program, the government has not come up with anything to suggest it's thwarted even one terrorist plot in 9 years. At best, they come up with it's helpful in providing background information to deduce the mindset of Al-Qaeda or terrorist. But that no longer, that does not come close to the threshold of urgency that the Fourth Amendment sets to justify encroaching on our liberty. And I want to underscore for your listeners, this concerns spying on Americans. This program is not relating to spying on Rousseff in Brazil or Angela Merkel or on Airbus or anything like that. Spying on Americans whose government is supposed to serve us, not the other way around.
And again, I'm speaking with Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statement. He's authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. And Bruce Fine is the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy. And his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. And he's been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was the lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Now, Bruce, are you, since you were senior advisor to Ron Paul in his 2012 campaign, are you advising his son, Rand Paul, Senator Paul?
Well, I don't have any formal association. I obviously, you know, have worked with him on particular pieces of legislation in the Senate. I do hope to, I'm working, actually, if your listeners, is to establishing an independent website that will be defending the Rand Paul philosophy. So your listeners should know I'm a strong supporter of Rand Paul, even though I'm not part of his formal campaign at present. And I have assisted, you know, the legislative activities, it's not political ones, that are ongoing with regard to not only the NSA, but war powers, oversight, and things like that.
Have you seen Rand Paul's ad that his PAC put out? It's a sort of parody on wrestling tournaments where he comes up, you know, bare-chested like a wrestler and threatens to wipe the floor with Lindsey Graham, who's in a little pink convertible. I mean, yeah. Have you seen it?
Yeah, well, it's a little too light for me. That's just the way I like Plutarch's Lives is the standard political conversation, but I can understand that particular element there. And yeah, if you want to know, Lindsey Graham's the one that said we'll all have, you know, Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts literally dead, you know, if this program isn't continued. And again, it's remarkable that he'd have the audacity to say that when, I repeat, 9 years and you come up with nothing. That's a pretty good standard that this is totally worthless. And I want to repeat, this was the same conclusion reached by President Obama's Privacy and Civil Liberties Board that had extensive time to examine the program. It's also the same conclusion reached in the last week by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, which was able to ask the FBI, well, what kind of use did you make of this intelligence? Oh, well, we really didn't use it in any major program, but, you know, it let us understand the first names, you know, of some people in Al-Qaeda or something of that sort. And that doesn't come close to the standard of need that is required for the government to begin to encroaching on our liberty.
So why do you think that Mitch McConnell is doing what he's doing? Because he doesn't look good. He doesn't look like he can control his own chamber. And he doesn't sound like he has a plan or an end game.
Well, I think what you're assuming, Ian, that politicians necessarily are insightful and unerring. Politicians can be very stupid and make dumb decisions. You know, Republicans have shut down the government and it's worked disastrously. They still made the decision, a staggering miscalculation. So you're asking what, you know, Mitch has been around for a long time. He's not a novice. But even people who have been there over long years can make huge mistakes. Lyndon Johnson was an expert, and we ended up with Gulf of Tonkin resolutions, and you know, he ultimately made decisions that drove himself out of office. So you're really right. It is a puzzle. How could Mitch be so foolish to propose extending a statute which the courts have said doesn't do what he wants it to do? I mean, even if he wins, he loses because he's got a statute passed that the courts say is a blank piece of paper. You know, why are you going through this exercise? But I just think it's a huge political blunder, and sometimes in the cauldron of Washington, D.C., you know, in a moment of hastiness, you make a very, very foolish decision. Because I surely agree with you. I mean, he could have just said, Mr. President, you know, you make the argument to extend it. I know I'm not going to do that. And he has all facts on his side. Namely, there aren't going to be, you know, any bodies on the street with the expiration of the program tomorrow. And he'll be vindicated, and the others will look like Chicken Littles yelling, the sky is falling down.
But the president's in favor of signing the USA Freedom Act, which passed the House in a very, very handy manner. And if the Senate starts to put in amendments and change the bill, can they bring the House back in? I mean, on such short notice?
Well, technically they could. Right now the House is out and is recess, you know, and they have two members, the Tom Massey of Kentucky and Justin Amash of Michigan, are standing on the floor to make sure that Speaker Boehner can't rush something through by unanimous consent. It would be, knowing how Washington works, I think it would be virtually impossible for the House to immediately reconvene, assuming that the Senate, you know, can get to some consensus on passing any form of the USA Freedom Act, and then rush back and have the House sign an identical bill. You know, listen, it's conceivable. You can have miracles even in the Bible. But certainly I wouldn't plan on it if you're, you know, a reasonable person of that happening. But I do think it is an inflection point here, I think, Ian, in our you know, extension as an empire, because to my mind, the best thing can happen if the expiration comes, nothing happens to the United States. Remember, even with the expiration, the National Security Agency is still collecting staggering amounts of information and intelligence under other authorities, more than any other intelligence agency in the world. And even before the Patriot Act, the NSA had authority to spy on foreign powers or agents of foreign powers or entities, so it's not losing its capacity to spy on terrorism. And the president continues with what he calls, it's an executive order, 12333, which he says empowers him to spy on us in the United States under some inherent Article II power to make us safe from foreign dangers. So the idea that, you know, we're going dark is utterly absurd. Does anyone really believe in the United States that if this program isn't extended past tomorrow, the NSA will shut down? Tens of thousands of employees will go home? No, it'll keep 99.9% of its spying and intelligence capacity totally, you know, undisturbed.
So what is Rand Paul going to get out of this? I mean, he did do a filibuster before. He's gotten a lot of notoriety from that. He's broken ranks with the Republicans very recently. He said that GOP hawks are responsible for the Islamic State, or ISIS. That was a pretty bold statement. He's certainly singling himself out as being a different kind of Republican. So how's it playing, do you think? Because my sense is that he probably, at the end of the day, would be the most effective Republican candidate against Hillary Clinton. Whether he'll get the nomination's another question.
Yeah, well, I think you need to have, you know, at least, you know, two lenses to examine this politically. On one, you know, how does it work out in the primary campaign? And two, what would be the impact on the general election? And primaries, again, can be different because in some states, independents can vote and some not. But I think it gives Rand the same prominence that he commanded when he was opposing Mr. Brennan, who believed the president could use predator drones to kill anybody he wanted in secret based on secret evidence. And I think he's got the same prominence this time around. He's the one that's been most vocal in opposing either an extension of the current act or the USA Freedom Act that doesn't go nearly far enough. It's more cosmetic than anything else. And I also think that it puts Rand uniquely in this presidential campaign in a position where he's the only one who can so-called reach across, you know, party lines, because there are many liberal Democrats who agree with Rand on this particular measure. For example, Ron Wyden of Oregon, who's a Democrat. And therefore, I think the American people searching for somebody who can bridge the partisan divide, Rand is the only one that even has any possible claim to that particular niche. It's not just with the USA, the spying and surveillance, but prison reform, decriminalizing marijuana, opposition to voter ID to suppress turnout when we ought to be encouraging informed voting, all those kinds of things. You know, too many blacks being incarcerated as youths for things that ought not to be criminalized, you know, like selling untaxed cigarettes or something. So to that degree, when the American people hungry for someone who isn't so partisan, I think this strengthens, you know, his position for that particular category of voter. And it's huge. You know, at present, 40% of the enrolled people who are registering are independent. They're not either Republicans or Democrats.
So in terms of the sky is falling, you mentioned this Chicken Little caucus. My understanding is what's really happening at the, and I spoke recently with a former NSA veteran who basically said that this is all about empire building, that they just get more and more money, build more and more programs, suck up more and more data. It's like instead of finding the needle in the haystack, they just keep pouring more hay on the haystack.
Yeah, and make it more difficult to find the needle, yeah.
Right, but they also create these empires through contracting. And remember,
oh, absolutely they do. Staggering amounts of money. You know, the one who can give you chapter and verse, and you may recall, because I participated on a program with you, Ann, is Thomas Drake. You know, offering staggering amounts of money consultancy. They give write intelligence reports for five different agencies. And when I say staggering amounts, I mean an ordinary person gets $500,000, Keith Alexander, $1 million per client for intelligence advice. And you're absolutely right. This is empire for the sake of empire. Surveillance for the sake of surveillance. And Mr. Drake told me that when he was in the NSA, they would have parties, office parties, each new trillionth megabit of data they collected against us. You know? Oh, hey, we passed a trillion. Now that it's really past trillions, Ian, they have new terminology that I can't even remember to describe the volume of intelligence they're collecting. I guess you got to be a specialist to even know, catch up with the lexicon to be current. But that's exactly what empires do, spying for the sake of spying. And one of the reasons why I believe there's such pressure to try to extend the act is they fear that they'll shown to be Chicken Littles. And when the act expires and nothing happens, there's no terrorism against us, you know, it'll be shown that the whole thing was a fraud. You had made all these claims and then nothing happened. And they're really frightened about that proposition. Because that empire starts to crumble. Why are we wasting $100 billion on something that's worthless? This is truly a white elephant. You know, it's the bridge to nowhere in the NSA.
Well, just in closing, there was a recent PBS Frontline documentary on the Pakistani-American terrorists behind the Mumbai attacks, and it was a very, very thoroughly well-done piece. But in the documentary, they had clips of General Alexander, the head of the NSA, and Hayden, the former head of the NSA and CIA, and Senator Feinstein and others, all claiming that these secret programs had prevented these terrorist attacks, and they were citing success in the Headley case of this Pakistani-American terrorist. And the documentary made it incredibly clear that those claims are totally false, that they had nothing. None of these programs had anything to do with this guy. So if the best example they can have is actually fraudulent, it really makes you say, in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, is there any cost-benefit analysis ever done? Is this?
No, there's not. And that is what's really, in my judgment, very telling. In the national security area, there's never any cost-benefit analysis. You just keep spending and spending and spending. And we have the absurdity that, at present, we have the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, going to Congress and saying, In 2015, in May, we've never been more imperiled as a nation from international terrorism. So this is 14 years after 9/11. Despite spending hundreds of billions of dollars on intelligence collection. And you'd figure they would ask, well, if we're more in danger now than in 9/11, maybe we're doing something wrong, you know, 14 years of failure. But no, just give us more money. It's like William Westmoreland asking for 200,000 more troops after the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. I mean, really? At that point, we had the brains with the help of the media, you know, to get out of Vietnam. But now we don't have the media, you know, be able to be as free as they were in Vietnam to bring back, you know, videos of the utter insanity and foolishness of what we're about. So we persist for a little bit longer, aside from the fact that we don't have a draft like we did in Vietnam that created further pressure to do something sensible. What you've stated really is quite true. How come there's no cost benefit? No one's asking, what are you getting from this? And you mentioned, Ian, earlier, the Lone Wolf Authority. Well, why do you have it? You've had it for 10 years. You've never used it once, you know? What's the cost benefit of that authority? You know, we don't give the government power just for the sake of a beauty contest, you know, so they can look, you know, strong like Mars or like Atlas. It's there because it's supposed to have some social use, and it sits there like a sort of Damocles never being used. And what abuse is this lying around like a loaded weapon on that score? But that's part of the reason why, in my judgment, Ian, you know, the listeners, we have to reinvigorate Congress with a true oversight. They've got to exercise their responsibilities to make certain that the money isn't abused, that our liberties are protected, and that we don't have the president unilaterally frightening everybody based upon bogus stories into surrendering our liberties. And to be candid, Congress has not done its job. A last observation I'd make, you know, all this discussion we're having today, Ian, all the maneuvering up on Congress now, the reason why there actually is a debate, is the reason is two words, Edward Snowden. And it really is disgraceful in our country that it took a 29-year-old, you know, to stimulate a proper democratic debate with transparency about an enormously important program because Congress sat there, you know, like a dead log. Even though it knew what was going on, it said nothing, even though they have speech or debate protection that would prevent any prosecution of them. And we can't have oversight by flukes of Ed Snowden. We have to institutionalize it. And if there's anything I could encourage your listeners to do, call in your member of Congress or the Senate and say, where are you in oversight? What have you been doing? You know, the neglect of duty, dereliction of duty. And that's the first step back to regaining a healthy republic that honors liberty.
Well, Bruce Fein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fein. He's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General under the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the United States Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. And Bruce Fein's the author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle of Our Constitution and Democracy, and his latest book is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and was a lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with a gay political activist, blogger, and the vice chairman of Raw Story, Inc. about the latest scandal involving a gay, closeted Republican lawmaker.
I'm more important in the USA.
Secret love's no secrets anymore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Rogers, who's a gay political activist, blogger, and the vice chairman of Raw Story, Inc. He is a leading subject of the 2009 film Outrage on the subject of outing closeted politicians. And in 2008, he founded the National Blogger and Citizens Journalist Initiative, now known as Netroots Connect program of Netroots Nation, where he serves as director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Rogers.
Thank you for having me on.
And Mike, we've spoken before, and I recall at the time when Dennis Hastert was the House Speaker, when he stepped down amid a scandal involving Congressman Mike Foley, Republican of Florida, who was forced to resign in 2008 after news came out that he'd been engaged in essentially courting young men who worked as congressional pages. So take us back to that time, because there, even then I recall, and who it was I spoke to at the time, who made some sort of hint that maybe Hastert himself was covering something up.
Well, it's interesting. In 2004, the Bush administration basically set up the Republican Party by making such a central part of their platform and their Get Out the Vote program. All of the anti-marriage equality amendments to state constitutions. So when that plan went into effect and they started to basically vilify gay people to get votes, a number of us realized, you know, it's time to start focusing attention on those that spend so much of their time and energy basically obsessing about gay people, always on their minds. So I set up Blog Active and started to investigate people, and around the time there was Mark Foley, you also had the case of Larry Craig, you had the case of Congressman Ed Schrock in 2004, who was recorded on a phone sex line seeking to meet somebody. So they set up this environment where, by their own vilification of gay people, by their own tactics, they create the Dennis Hasterts of the world. They create the Mark Foleys because they are so negative about gay people. Those folks say, oh, I better stay in the closet. And the closet is never good. It never helps. And ultimately, it sets people up like Dennis Hastert to owe millions of dollars, to pay it illegally, and then to be indicted, all because of who his desires are for. I mean, the whole thing is rather preposterous.
Well, it's sad, too, isn't it? It's tragic.
You know, it's pathetic. It's, it is, you know, it is a pathology. And it's interesting, in Outraged, Andrew Sullivan, of course, who's the conservative commentator, in my opinion, said that these people have a pathology. Well, if they have a pathology, that means they're pathological. And their lie, the way they operate, has become so intrinsic to who they are that you can have a person like Denny Hastert sit up there and say, make me speaker because I don't have any skeletons in my closet. I mean...
Well, but and this is after he's led the crusade against Clinton for...
Bill Clinton,
trying to impeach the president for a dalliance, a consensual sex with Monica Lewinsky.
With an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole thing, and I don't want to excuse Bill Clinton's behavior, but in the context that Democrats handle this stuff on the Democratic side, the Democratic side doesn't sit and obsess about people's pelvises, whether it's gay people or a woman's right to choose or things like you have to have a sonogram or a probe. They're all about controlling that part of people's lives. And it, to the point of an obsession, when these guys say being gay is a choice, it's because they make the decision to not come out. So they make the choice. It's the only way you can justify that answer, really.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Rogers, who's a gay political activist, blogger, and vice chairman of Raw Story, Inc. He is a leading subject of the 2009 film Outrage on the subject of outing closeted politicians. And in 2008, he founded the National Blogger and Citizens Journalist Initiative, now known as the Netroots Connect program of Netroots Nation, where he serves as director. So Larry Craig, what was extraordinary about him was he was pretty much caught red-handed, but yet he denied and denied and denied. And the movie Outrage makes it very clear that he had a secret life with numerous gay encounters. I recall in the movie there was somebody that had actually had sex with Larry Craig and described this sort of cheap tip that he was given.
David Phillips.
Yeah,
About his experience.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. But what explains that? I mean, in both Hastert's case and in Larry Craig's case, they both married. Hastert's got two sons, one of whom's a lobbyist for Boeing and Lockheed and these military contracts. And of course, Hastert himself has been a very obviously incredibly successful lobbyist because he's got, what, $3.5 million to throw away to cover up some pathetic little encounter he had with a high school kid back when he was a wrestling coach in Yorkville.
Right, and I think what's interesting, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. My question essentially is how do these people maintain this extraordinary denial? And in the case of Larry Craig, to this day, even in the face of mountains of evidence, still insists that it didn't happen.
It is a level of denial in these men that runs so deep that you'll notice when Larry Craig was interviewed by Matt Lauer, he said, "Are you gay?" And he said, "No, Larry, I don't live in that lifestyle." Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that you don't hang out on 17th Street and go to the gym? Because that's what a lot of people portray the, quote, gay lifestyle to be. You know, or does it mean that you don't go to disco clubs? Or does it mean that you don't go to fire? What does it mean that... So basically what they reduce themselves to is the difference of gay people versus men who have sex with men. And they are the latter of the two. They will never perceive themselves to be, quote, gay, because they'll never accept who they are, and therefore they'll never come out. And it's their own people who caused this situation. That is the insanity of it all. Their philosophies create a situation where people are pushed into the closet like this. Not the Democrats.
Right. Well, you know, Barney Frank is, of course, is the opposite example, if you will. But the damage that they do because of their manifest hypocrisy to gay and lesbian rights, which it seems to be moving ahead in spite of them, though. The only justification for this conversation we're having, as far as I'm concerned, since I don't believe that anybody should judge anybody else's private lives, is what they do publicly and how they vote, and they vote against gay rights.
People say to me that who are you to decide what a gay person should vote? Who are you to say that a gay person has to vote for gay marriage? Maybe they genuinely think, based on their religious or other beliefs, that marriage is between a man and a woman. I have no problem with it. I mean, I have a problem with it, but in the context of my work, I have no problem with it as long as you're honest, as long as you say, "I'm a gay man and I don't believe in marriage equality." You don't get to say something against my community and then expect my community to protect you, to keep your confidence, to encounter you in bars and have sex with you and all of those things that happen, and then expect that somehow in that transaction I owe you privacy when you want to deny me equality.
So what's happened then to this sort of extraordinary kind of clique of gay staffers on the Republican side on the Hill? Is that still operating?
There's certainly, I mean, it grows and it grows. I meet more and more people who tell me that they, you know, they're working hard in the Republican Party to create change, and that, you know, they're out at work. And I say, well, you're really out at work? Well, the people I work with know. The congressman or the senator doesn't know I'm gay. And so to me, that somebody would have such low self-esteem that they could go to work and hide from the very people they work for the truth of who they are. You know, what's happening is even younger LGBT people are saying, you know, I'm sorry, younger non-LGBT people are saying, it's enough already. Stop beating my friends up. I have family members who are Republicans. They don't want to hear that I'm bad because I think people should be able to get married. Hopefully you'll get the message, because this is what they create when they don't. The Larry Craigs, the Mark Foley's, the Denny Hastert's, because they vilify gays so much, they create these situations themselves.
So in terms of his lobbying, the fact that he was able to pay $1.7 million and apparently had agreed to pay $3.5 million, he must have been making a hell of a lot of money as a lobbyist.
You know, it's really funny. Every 2 to 4 years, somebody rolls into town and they put forth how I am going to reform ethics and make changes to the ethics world and bring about limits on all of this. So they set up all of these limits, but then deep in the text, buried so far in the text, you don't see all the exemptions. One of the classic ones is that 501c3 or C4 organizations can't lobby Congress unless they have a 501c3. That's a new rule, but they come out and they say, these people can't lobby because there's some people that are not actually allowed to lobby anymore. So the same thing happens with this. People will scream, we've done all this wonderful ethics reform and all of this, and then you have people come out, they join these firms. These firms make millions upon millions of dollars. Lobbyists write the laws in turn. They're often actually, and I don't say that with sarcasm, they actually have people who are in these meetings helping to draft legislation. So it's no wonder they make so much money. And, you know, it's the cash out. Look at all of these guys who are in Congress and then look at them 5 years later.
Well, but that's the part that I find extraordinary, that they can so brazenly trade in their public service for private gain through this revolving door and do it so shamelessly. And it's not the exception in Washington. It's the rule, isn't it?
You know, it's I don't know anybody, and I know a lot of people who are in politics. I don't know anybody who worked for the government and went to work in the private sector that wasn't able to use those connections and wasn't able to earn money on that fact. But I'll tell you why it's shameless. There's a simple reason it's shameless. The American people simply don't care. More Americans can tell you about Kim Kardashian than can tell you about the Trans-Pacific Trade the partnership, the TPP. So the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that's really scary considering we're climbing into bed with nations that condone slavery.
Right.
So that no one knows about unless they're listening to responsible radio, basically. You know, again, they're too busy paying attention to the next sale at Target and what is Kim Kardashian wearing to the music awards. That's why it happens. If people paid attention, it wouldn't happen.
Right. Well, of course, they also pay attention to these kind of salacious scandals that that we're talking about here with Dennis Hastert and Individual A. And it does seem that Individual A is probably the person who called in on the C-SPAN show, calling himself Bruce, with a kind of cryptic comment and a rather sort of demonic laugh.
I heard it. I can't speak to... I personally can't speak to whether or not that was the same gentleman. I know that people are trying to figure all that out, I'm sure. You know, that'll keep CNN good for about 5 days.
Right.
Well, obsessing about that. And it's an important story, and they should be covering it, don't get me wrong. But why aren't they covering other news that really affects people in their day-to-day lives? Because it doesn't pay for them, because people don't care and therefore don't watch.
So here we are. You're condemning the very conversation we're having, but I'm going to pursue it nevertheless.
But I think
inquiring minds want to know, Mike. You know.
But in terms of analyzing something like this at this point, I think it's important, because when we're doing it on a show like this versus 42 seconds at the top of Hollywood Tonight, there's a huge difference. So I wouldn't put a dialogue like this, because we're talking about what creates this. What has this done to society? How has it set back people? And I think that's important analysis. But you're also talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And
right.
They're not, because it's not, people don't turn on the TV for that. So it's about a balance. So
right.
Don't beat yourself up.
No, I'm not. But what I wanted to sort of speculate on was, at the end of the day, because inevitably we'll find out who this high school kid that obviously Hastert was his wrestling coach and they had some kind of sexual encounter. But at the end of the day, it's what I find extraordinary is that how much this sexual encounter has been monetized, whether it was, brief or passing or whatever. The idea that it was worth
right.
$3.5 million, my God, that's got to be some kind of record.
Well, for me, what it makes me wonder about is, so you have this guy at $3.5 million. Now, I can't tell you he's the only guy that they've ever alleged he's been with, or that he's been with, if he has in fact been with these guys, because this, of course, is all alleged. That at $3.5 million a pop, that's a lot of money if there's more than one. Either way, it's a lot of money. So I'm not quite sure what he was thinking or what the circumstances were. We don't know. I do think it's important to say that if it was a high school student, and people knew about this at some point early on, I want to know why didn't they step forward to protect this kid? And if they didn't know, were there any others? And what should they go back and should they seek and should they find out? And also to make sure, in fairness, that they're not getting pretenders, that every, kid who served at the high school where he taught should feel, well, that happened to me. So it'll be interesting to see the follow-up afterward.
Well, but just in closing, Mike Rogers, is Washington has it improved since 2008 when the movie Outrage came out? No, 2009?
Absolutely. And I think that in its own small part, it helped to contribute that the work, because it's very easy now to walk up to somebody who is against gay equality, against LGBT equality, and say to them, so how did you feel? How do you feel about Ken Melman? Or how do you feel about Denny Hastert? Or how do you feel? Like, they have to own these people. So what's happening is you don't hear the presidential candidates, now and then, but and maybe Rick Santorum, but you don't hear them talking about marriage. Pretty much in their minds, they don't want to go near it. They don't want to have to answer a question about it. They don't want to have to come up with a plan, because they know it's a losing issue.
Right. Well,
they know it.
Right. The Supreme Court's probably going to get them off the hook in that regard.
We don't know. And we don't know. I think the reaction will be much stronger than people expect if the Supreme Court rules for marriage equality. It scares me what I think people are capable of.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mike Rogers.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Rogers, who's a gay political activist and blogger and the vice chairman of Raw Story, Inc. He is a leading subject of the 2009 film Outrage on the subject of outing closeted politicians. And in 2008, he founded the National Blogger and Citizens Journalist Initiative, now known as Netroots Connect program of Netroots Nation, where he serves as director. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the possibility of a war between Israel and Hezbollah this summer. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and the president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article with Paul Piller at the Huffington Post, The Iran Talks Game Changer, An Israeli-Hezbollah War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the idea that so far the P5 plus one talks with Iran have succeeded, or at least they're on track, in spite of the efforts of the powerful lobby on Capitol Hill, AIPAC, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech before the Congress. The Saudis, of course, have been weighing in, as have the Gulf states, to try and scuttle the deal. But it's on track. But what you're arguing, along with Paul Piller in the Huffington Post, is that the real game changer could happen in the summer if Israel goes to war against Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Correct. Essentially, we're not saying this is going to happen. We're not saying it's a foregone conclusion. But we're saying that it could happen. And if it did happen, the main objective, the main driver, may not be to hit Hezbollah, although that definitely would be one of the drivers, because of Hezbollah having rearmed, because Hezbollah being weakened right now and overextended, which then gives the Israelis an opportunity to hit them now rather than being hit later. In fact, that's the very argument some Israelis are making in the media over there, saying war with Israel is inevitable. It might as well happen on our choosing rather than on Israel's choosing. But if it happens, a key objective may actually be to try to kill the Iran deal, because so far, with everything they've done, they have not managed to shift the American public to their side. And likely, if the vote were to be held today, the president would likely manage to defend his deal and avert any successful attempt by the Senate to derail it. So they need a game changer. And the argument that has been used but has not been fully efficient thus far is the argument that how can you make a deal with Iranians, because that would lead to a situation in which the Iranians would have more money and they would give a lot of that money to Hezbollah, which would then be able to use it against Israel. That argument so far has not been particularly effective. However, if you have a scenario in which Hezbollah rockets actually are flying into Israel, then it is foreseeable that that argument would be much more effective and could create significant problems for the president. He may lose a lot of Democrats who thus far have been supportive of the president.
Well, from sources that I've talked to that are familiar with the situation on the ground in Syria, say that Iran's influence, particularly with the Syrian military, has grown to the point where they're actually, the IRGC, Quds, and Hezbollah are essentially holding up the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad and the Alawites. Without Iran's help, they would have collapsed already. And apparently there have been purges of Syrian military officers who have objected to the influence of Iran over defending Syria. So if that's the case, then it would seem to indicate two things to me. On the one hand, as you've said, that the Israelis see Hezbollah being overextended and bogged down in Syria, and therefore the time is ripe to strike them. But on the other hand, the Israelis may make the calculation that if the rump part of Syria that the Assad's control ends up being essentially controlled by Hezbollah and Iran, that would also pose national security problems for Israel.
Certainly. And what we are arguing essentially is saying that there are many factors that the Israelis themselves are citing right now as justifications of going into war with Hezbollah. But the one factor that may actually push them over the edge and cause them to make a decision that probably will be a very tough political decision at the end of the day is the temptation that it may also have this added plus of scuttling the Iran talks. Because, again, if you have that type of a war, it would be very difficult for the president to strike or to defend a deal with the Iranians in the midst of that type of a fighting.
So do you think then that the Israeli leadership can make that kind of a calculation? If as Hezbollah has suggested, and as an Iranian military leader has suggested, that they could rain down 1,200 rockets a day on Israel, And according to the Iranian military official, General Yehda Ramin Safavi, who's the military advisor to the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, he, in your article, you say that on May the 21st, he warned that any Israeli attack would unleash a firestorm of missiles on its city. Quoting, "Iran, with the help of Hezbollah and its friends, is capable of destroying Tel Aviv and Haifa in cases of military aggression on the part of the Zionists." That's quoting the Iranian general. So would an Israeli leader put his country at risk like that?
Well, the problem is that the Israeli assumption is that the war with Hezbollah is inevitable. This is something that's going to happen anyway. The Hezbollah forces are rearming. They're at war with Israel de facto. The prospects of peace with them is very slim, if even existing. And Hezbollah may soon be much, much stronger as a result of the nuclear deal. That's their calculation. So as a result, it is not whether there should or there should not be a military confrontation with Hezbollah. The question is, when would it be?
And Paul Pillar, of course, is a senior retired CIA officer who, I think, wasn't he the National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East?
He was, yes.
Yeah. So in terms of, in your article, Dr. Tridipasi, that what's been said on the Israeli side that gives you reason to suspect that this is a real possibility, particularly when you quote Ambassador Dori Gold, who's now been made the foreign minister, hasn't he?
He's the head. He's the director general of the Israeli Foreign Ministry. So, while we were drafting the piece, he was appointed,
right?
And he had been very active in the media, saying some of these things. And again, we're not saying this is going to happen, but we're saying it is a possibility. And I think it would be problematic to dismiss the likelihood that something like this could happen.
Well, the quote from Dori Gold is that either the IDF will have to destroy the weapons now being stored in southern Lebanon or let Hezbollah fire thousands of rockets into Israel. What would you do? Now, the question is there any military way to preempt a Hezbollah counterattack?
I think the Israelis are quite aware that if there was to be some form of military confrontation, there would be a high price. I mean, last time, Israel essentially ended up failing to defeat Hezbollah. So it would be highly problematic. And at that time, the war dragged on for 34 days. Ground troops were put in, and still they couldn't defeat Hezbollah.
Well, but they did flatten the entire, as far as I could tell, most of the Hezbollah area of Beirut, did they not?
They certainly destroyed a lot of southern Lebanon and parts of Beirut. But nevertheless, they did not succeed in defeating Hezbollah. Hezbollah is still there. And again, what it comes down to is a belief that there is going to be a military confrontation at some point. And then the question is, at what point will Israel have the greatest strategic advantage? At what point will it have the greatest disadvantage? And that's what's pushing, that's the argument that is pushed for by people like Dori Gold and others to essentially say a preemptive strike is needed. And that preemptive strike is needed before a deal has been struck, because once the deal is struck and once the Iranians are benefiting from the sanctions relief, of which some may end up in Hezbollah hands, that's when Israel would lose a lot of its advantages.
So what, just in the meantime then, since this is a scenario that's, to my mind, is fairly credible, and what kind of pushback could there be to avert this catastrophe?
Well, I think, first of all, if there is an awareness that the motivation may actually be to undermine the peace prospects for a nuclear deal, that in and of itself could be a deterrent against doing this. That doesn't necessarily mean that you won't end up seeing some sort of a confrontation between Israel and Hezbollah down the road, but I think greater awareness in and of itself can have the impact of deterring Israel going down this route. And I also think it would be a huge strategic miscalculation by the Israelis, even if they managed to push back the Iran nuclear deal. In fact, precisely if they were to succeed in doing so, because in the long run, the deal is going to be good for Israel. It's going to be much better for Israel to have an Iran that is more integrated into the global economy, that is enabling a society to be unleashed. It's a very moderate society that would push Iran in a much more moderate direction. It's not a society that wants to have a conflict with Israel. It would weaken the radical forces in Iran. And in the long run, that would be of a significant advantage to the Israelis as well, because the Iranians know very well they're not going to be able to have a functioning relationship with the United States if they continue the same line against Israel that they had in the past. And there are people in Israel who I think who recognize this, but they are not necessarily the ones that are calling the shots right now.
Well, but surely we know that there's a pretty prickly relationship between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and my sense is that Netanyahu is not happy with the situation. He's made it real clear that he wants to kill this deal, and it's not being killed, and Obama's still standing, and they've tried everything they could to scuttle it and use the Senate, and still Obama's standing, and this would be the one thing that would reverse the tables, wouldn't it? I mean, there'd be no way in the world that President Obama could dissuade Netanyahu, do you think, based upon what we know about their relationship, which is not particularly cordial?
It seems very difficult to be able to persuade Netanyahu. At best, perhaps one could persuade him to be less obstructive, but the idea that he would be supportive or even neutral would be very difficult to see. And again, I think he has a political interest to push this further. And if this undermines Obama's chances of establishing an Iran deal as a legacy for himself, then that may actually be an additional perk with going down this path. Of course, there are going to be other elements involved. It's not that easy to be able to launch a major military confrontation. There's going to be elements in the U.S. military, et cetera, in the Israeli military, that are probably going to have different views. But bottom line is that the view within the Israeli military that there is a threat from Hezbollah and that some form of a confrontation more or less is inevitable is wildly shared. That's not a view that is only held by people supporting Netanyahu.
Well, this is a tough one, isn't it? If it comes to pass, just in closing, I don't see much that's going to stop this steamroller if it's unleashed?
It does have the ability. I certainly can see it having the calculation behind it to be able to scuttle the talks, but you never know how these things end up. I mean, the way the Israelis thought that the Lebanon confrontation with Hezbollah would end up in 2006 ended up being completely incorrect. So the region is full of surprises. People make a lot of miscalculations these days.
Well, Dr. Tridipasi, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Tridipasi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article with Paul Piller at the Huffington Post, The Iran Talks Game Changer, an Israeli Hezbollah War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.